right. Moin moin from Hamburg. This time in English. Welcome to the Nettohypertrophie podcast powered by the Art of Personal Training. My name is Arne Otte, the host of the show. In advance, bear with me with my English. You know, I'm not that often with English speaking guests over here. So if there's some oohs and ahs and I don't know the word, bear with me. I would try my very, very best to keep that flowing and stuff. So today I'm very honored and very happy to have Luke Miller from No Switch Fitness on the podcast, all the way from Texas, yeah, which is 8 a.m. in the morning, you told me.
Yeah, 8 a.m.
Okay, first coffee?
I actually have not gotten my coffee yet. I woke up a little late, so I'm just rocking up water right now. We should be good, though. I'm pretty good in the morning.
All right. He's good in the morning. So some people who probably, if you don't know Luke is a passionate bodybuilder himself, a prep coach, owner of No Switch Fitness. And I would say an great example of someone who is applying science-based knowledge and anecdotal experience and make those two applicable to the individual that wants to reach max hypertrophy adaptations, which is the stuff that I like to talk most about and which I also like to do most of my time of the day. So Luke, great to have you here. How you doing and what have you trained yesterday and what was your last meal to keep the audience a bit in touch?
Yeah, so yesterday was shoulder focus push, so that was a pretty good session. We have back and hamstrings on the docket today. And then breakfast this morning was two English muffins, two whole eggs, 30 grams protein from whey, 65 grams of oats, and 75 grams of berries. So I'm at the point now where food doesn't really go down very easy. So most of that's blended in a shake, and then I have my eggs and muffins on the side.
So, crazy. So yeah. How long is your off-season going now?
We started in July, so I stopped to prep, so I was about 5 weeks out, and my wife decided that she wanted to give her pro card another run. Mm-hmm. And the next national show was about 6 days before I was supposed to compete. So you can imagine that's not a very good setup for me prepping my wife to be 6 days out trying to peak her for another run. She had missed her pro card by one spot at the first one. So I ended up stopping my prep, and she ended up going another like 2 or 3 weeks and then not making it to the next national show. But it was fun. It was a good prep. So since July, we ended that prep at around 214. I got up to like 253, and I'm sitting around 243, 244 right now. So I'm kind of bringing it back down a bit just to kind of keep health metrics in play, and a couple other things, just making sure that we are ready for the next push up, because I need to be around 260, 255, 260 before I prep again.
Right. So how much calories do you have to get in right now?
Oh, man. I think it's at 47 on training days, or 48 on training days, 4,800. And then rest days are like 38, 37.
So okay. Food's decent. Now that makes sense to make a shake out of that stuff. And just get it in. That's crazy. Yeah. For me, it's funny that you talked about it, because I was able last season, I was able to get two competitions in, and that the final one, which was the most exciting for me, the German Championships, I eat salad the day before and got sick of food poisoning in the morning when I wanted to drive to the competition. I was completely had fever and stuff, and I couldn't move and stuff. It was not a good thing to have.
It'll ruin a show weekend, that's for sure.
Yeah, in the morning. Yeah, and I would say 10 hours later, that stuff was out of the system and I was good, but the show was done. So the next time, I need some people who taste my food before I eat. That's the stuff. Yeah, people like Usain Bolt. I never know that they got people like that tasting their food and before their competitions. That's crazy. I never thought about that. All right. Before we talk too much about food and food poisoning and not making shows, hopefully the next show for you will be. You will made it to that.
It was a personal choice. I decided myself, because coach first, athlete second for me. It's kind of where I come from. So I had to prioritize coaching over
that's also a good topic I could talk about for ages, which it's always hard to keep which head to keep on and which priority to keep, because we love to do that sport, we love to coach, but you have to keep priorities in check. You have to do. So look, to keep things running for people that don't know you, could you explain the people why you choose the name No Switch Fitness? What stands that for? Is the philosophy behind that?
Yeah, for sure. So No Switch Fitness, the philosophy is no off switch in the pursuit of results. Basically what that comes from is, like, from a personality type wise, I've always been kind of completely into something or just not really cared. I've been described like a light switch. Like, I'm either on or off about it. And so kind of going into that, like, I wanted my business to be a representation of, like, how I feel about bodybuilding. And it is, like, all encompassing passion of mine that, like, I really want to bring to the forefront a better way to do it, a better way to coach, a better way to be an athlete. And that's where, like, No Switch Fitness comes from, is, like, taking no off switch in the pursuit of results. So doing whatever it is that you have to do in order to make it, and making sure that we are in the constant pursuit of being better, no matter what the phase is, whether it's contest prep, whether it's off season, what we're doing should be leading to a better version of ourselves. And I think that mentality cross applies, right? Like, I think it's bodybuilding specific, but it can cross apply into anything, right? It can cross apply into how you run your business, how you treat your job, how you treat your personal life. And I think that's something that it's evolving into as we kind of get deeper and deeper into it and the community grows, is like, look, like, bodybuilding is our passion and what it's all centered around, but we can take no off switch in the pursuit of results when it comes to anything within our life. And for me personally with the business, it's about bringing people up, and it's about, like, elevating the standard at which we hold coaches and athletes, to be honest. This is kind of where, like, the education side of my business comes in, is the seminars, the content I do through J3U, all of that is meant to create a higher level of coaching and a higher level of athlete. So that an industry that I see has a lot of problems in it, when I'm done with it, I've left it a lot better. And I've informed a lot of people. And then the meta impact of that, of, like, the people that I've impacted and are now impacting their clientele, which are now impacting their clientele, just leads to an overall better standard of coaching. And I think there's a good wave of that coming through. I think there's a lot of people who are putting out, or some good people that are putting out really good information. And I really just want to be kind of like the flag bearer for that, as far as moving it forward with not only the education side, but the way that I coach as well.
Moin Moin, ich bin's Arne. Kurze Unterbrechung, um dich auf unseren Coaching-Service hinzuweisen. Wenn du schon des Längeren damit kämpfst, deinen Hypertrophie-Fortschritt konstant positiv auszurichten und du eine sehr persönliche und motivorientierte Zusammenarbeit mit einem Coach schätzen würdest, dann check den Link in der Beschreibung und melde dich.
Mhm. Great, because that's how I get to know you. I saw your content and stuff with J3U and stuff. That's as you said, that's a lot of stuff that's not going really good in the industry. Especially, I'm from my stance. I just come from personal training industry. Yeah, straight from the gym floor. Coming from there, then transferring to the online coaching market like six years ago. I see the same stuff happening over there, where you got, I would say, the black and white thinking, where you got those science-based guys, where you got those just intensity guys. And it's so much, so important to bring both or all the aspects together. And that's when I see No Switch Fitness as something that brings all the stuff together, and see the individual in front of you. That's what we should all do as coaches, bring them forward, bring them to their goals. So that's a great philosophy to have and to make the industry better. Yeah, you already did that for sure. I could say that. So when it comes to the bodybuilding itself, because it's a bodybuilding podcast, also coaching is a big part of it. When we go all the way back to the foundation, to the base. So if people are hearing or they come to you, Ah, oh, man, Luke, I'm bodybuilding. I'm doing it stuff for a long time. I want to be the most productive bodybuilder. I want to be a competent bodybuilder. What are the most powerful things that comes to your mind when people would ask you that?
Yeah, so I think the consistency and execution is probably the biggest piece that I can see that's very easy to work with. And by consistency and execution, just being able to simply do what you're asked, like keep a consistent schedule, execute consistently on like your nutrition, execute consistently on your training, and be receptive to learning. I think that you kind of made a point about like things being black and white for a lot of people. And I think that that leads to a lot of misunderstanding when we look at like taking a bodybuilder from where they're at to the next level. There's often a learning process that has to occur with that. And I think that being receptive to that learning process is probably one of the biggest aspects that I see working in favor for athletes when they're moving up the ranks, and being able to do that. So like, just to give you guys an example, like Mitch is one of my classic physique pros. We just turned pro together at Nationals in December. And when he started coaching with me like a year and a half ago, or I guess almost 2 years now, a year and a half ago, his training was really like kind of bro setup, bro execution, just kind of go in there, sling some weights, things like that. We were able to take him from like a fourth place regional show physique into winning his pro card within that year because he just completely listened to everything that I had asked him to change, like completely revamped his training style, completely revamped the consistency in which he executed. And it paid off. Like, and I think when you have an athlete like that, that basically just says, look, like I'm here to work and I want to learn at the same time, the sky's the limit for that person, because that person is going to be able to, no matter where they're at, continuously improve. And I think that that's probably the biggest thing, because in bodybuilding, we have a lot of big egos. We have a lot of people who hang on to those big egos. And look, I get it. It's part of it, but it's learning to take that next step up to the next level that I think really gets people to where they want to go.
Yeah, for sure. The ego stuff is something that when we started our journey in this sport, it's probably it's not that bad, because it brings us from point A to B in the first few months and years probably. But yeah, then when it comes to the more nitty-gritty stuff like execution, yeah, the right intensities, relative and stuff, and mindset, then it will be something that will hinder us to grow to the next, get to the next level. I think what is most, or what I see a lot of time when athletes struggle to get to the next level, like the next level of athlete, is the struggle between the balance between intensity, so like learning how to work hard in the gym, proper execution of what you are doing with your body, the action, and keep that in a productive balance, I would say. Like that's pretty hard. That's also an ego stuff thing. What's your stance on that, or what how do you see that?
Yeah, I would 100% agree, man. I think even for your people who are advanced and have an understanding of that, it's a constant revisiting of like, what is that balance? I think that being objective with like training footage and being willing to take that training footage and maybe having someone else look at that training footage so that they're a little bit more objective than yourself is where that line starts to be creative or created. I will say that I would 100% rather pick up someone who understands the effort piece and I teach them the execution rather than the other way around, because the effort piece is intangible and it's hard to teach, especially with the online sphere that we're in. It's part of the reason why when people come and train with me, the first thing that I typically ask them to come train is a leg day. And it's not to be like a jerk or anything. It's more just to be like, hey, like this is the standard at which we're holding ourselves, right? And it's the standard that we should be holding ourselves. And I think when we look at like finding the balance, I think we can even have a balance like intra-session. So like your top set can be a little bit more on the aggressive side. Execution stays in place, obviously, but maybe that last 1 to 2 reps starts to slide a bit. And then the back off is really accurate within the movement. Now, injury risk will kind of tell you whether you're able to take that or not. Like for me right now, like with leg training, like everything needs to be absolutely pristine. And I lean into the accuracy side right now, just because I'm dealing with some injury profiles that if I do get a little bit more on the aggression side, it can like ding off those injuries pretty quick. So for me, it's a balance for each client too. Like what injury profiles are we dealing with? What are we having to fix? But 100%, like finding the balance is hard, but I think it's teachable, especially if you get in there and just learn how to work. I think that you may not know, but a concept that Ben Pakulski used to talk about was like pulling your balls out of your purse. And excuse my French for whoever may take that as offensive, but his concept was like, there's some days and some sessions that may not make sense on paper, but it's simply there just to build character. And I 100% think that there's value in that. And I've definitely had a lot of those in my day where it was like someone that I looked up to or coming to the gym just wanted to bury me in the dirt, and we went through it and got through, right? There's a lot of value within that. And so I think that if we're going to lean one way or the other, I would 100% someone lean towards the effort side and then learn the execution, which is hard in an information age because there's so much information available. People are like, oh, I have to have this at this angle and this reps in reserve and then accumulate the volume in this way and all this other stuff. And it's like, I think you're missing the big rocks, right? Like the big rocks of progress. And I think if we can maybe nail those down first, we can start to talk about the other stuff. But until we nail those down, I don't know how important some of the other stuff can be.
So the character building side that you mentioned is definitely something that, as you mentioned, is hard to work on that. If it's a skill, work on that in the online world. Yeah. So it's pretty hard. It's possibly to get that better in athletes, with videos and stuff, but it's not the same as being on the gym floor. I told it or said it a lot of times since when I was a personal trainer, that there's stuff that you don't see in videos, perspectives. There's the funny thing I always think, even things you can hear, like a popping knee or something, or smell or even something. It's completely different for the coaching eye and how someone is working, if he's working hard or if he's got a lot more in the tank. It's not that easy to see that in videos and stuff. And that's also a part which for my journey, which I absolutely lacked in the beginning when it comes to that. And because of the stuff you also mentioned, because I always wasn't seeing myself as a bodybuilder. I thought I wasn't good enough. Yeah, as a natural athlete, sometimes you think, oh man, I'm not muscular enough to call myself a bodybuilder. So I didn't do that to have the burden on myself. And when I started to do that, I had to learn to work really hard in the gym. And that's when the science stuff came in. And I wanted to learn about it and want to know everything about it and want to think, why does it work and what doesn't work? That worked to a great degree for me and my clients, to the point where I just thinking about like RERs and stuff and didn't apply myself in the gym anymore to be the next level athlete that I wanted to be. Yeah, and that's most of the time, I think that's if you don't reach a good level at that, it's not that easy to counter that, but even proper execution, better exercise selection or programming.
Yeah, and I think that's where we start to bridge research and anecdote, right? It's like we can understand the research literature and have maybe even understand its value, like and maybe have perspective from some of these papers, although most of them are not going to be hyper specific to our population. Mm-hmm. And then look at the anecdote and just the trend that we see over time And then combine those and be like, look, like there's value in both, but I am going to place more value in this just because in general over time, like you've seen plenty of bodybuilders who just work and work hard and train like trash and end up doing really well, right? Like and part of that genetic, but I think more often than not, if we look at the trends, it's just the people who just work hard are the ones that end up doing better than the ones who are just dipping their toe in the water, you know.
As you said, if it's intensity or execution, I think the example you bring by yourself, it's always a spectrum of both, and there are times of those two variables when they are appropriate to be more on one side of the spectrum, and there are appropriate time frames bring you on in the long-term view. But if you're always on one side of the spectrum, you're missing out on the good stuff you find on the other side. So that's, I think that's the most, one of the most powerful things when it comes to coaching athletes, to keep them on the productive side of the spectrum when it comes to the most powerful things we can do when it comes 100%. To bodybuilding. Yeah. So what was the quote from Ben Pakalski? Once again, it's completely cool to curse on here.
it's just saying to pull your balls out of your purse. And it's just a term. It's like, look, like stop leaving stuff in the tank and leave it all out on the floor. Right. Like that's really just what it stands for. And I think that aligns with like psychologically where I come from with like no off switch in the pursuit of results. Like I don't want to leave knowing that I left anything on the table for progress, right? And that's kind of where 100% where like the psychology kind of comes from.
Yeah, where when you grow mentally, yeah, the character building completely transform into new muscle tissue over time, which is stuff that also a lot of people don't think much, don't take note on that or use that stuff enough. Some hard sets, I guess most of the people know some sets that they will never forget that are the
same. Yeah, 100%.
That's where it may click and it's, now I know where my benchmark is. I know where, now I can work reps in reserve if I want to. So let's move on a little bit from the base work, the fundamentals,
yeah,
the more nitty gritty stuff, which we also, everybody on here that hears us like to talk about. I think most, a lot of people that will hear this podcast would call themselves intermediate athletes, yeah, at least. Yeah. And most of those people want to reach the next level, which would be an advanced athlete. Yeah, we can talk about the definition a bit of that. So when it comes to the intermediate, to someone who you would categorize advanced, when it comes to exercise selection, what are parts of stuff that you thought about, stuff that you do that's relevant when it comes to that?
Yeah, so I think this is interesting. I think programming in the intermediate phase, like let's say like someone who's writing their own programming, they're an intermediate and they're writing their own programs. I think what happens a lot of times is they start at the wrong point. So they just kind of hop into the program writing. And I think there needs to be a step back, a removal process of what I would call a needs analysis. So a needs analysis is just a document that walks you through what does this person need? And the way that I structure it is, first off, I do a pose by pose breakdown. So you got to do all your mandatories for whatever class you're in. And we do a pose by pose breakdown of like what stands out as strong points, what's weak points, what do we need to add, things like that. I use that to kind of create like what's recurringly weak. Like, is it lats from the front and from the rear? Is it shoulders from the front and from the side? Like these kinds of things to kind of start to categorize these body parts into priorities. So like body parts that really need to come up the most. Middle of the road, which is body parts that are not strong, but they're not weak. And then like your stronger body parts. And then down at the bottom, what I'm doing is I'm mapping out what I think could possibly be some movement issues or movement inhibitions based on the development of the athlete. So we can look at like structure. So like, what is someone's rib cage structure? How tall are they? How short are they? How is their rib cage to pelvis presentation look like? What does their overall muscular development kind of show you in how they move? Things like that to kind of build out what I would call a hypothesis of like, I'm pretty sure this person's going to have problems here, here, and here. I'm going to do some testing to see if that's the case. And so I'll start with the testing. And then the testing leads into mapping out the split design and the program itself. So I also would separate the split design and the program design itself, because programming should be sequencing one session into another, where the split design is just kind of giving you the priorities of the body parts that you're structuring. So I'll kind of start with the split design based on someone's schedule, someone's needs, off the needs analysis, and just overall what they can handle from like a schedule perspective. And then from there, I'm writing the program sequentially according to that. And so where you start to go down this funnel of what does an intermediate versus an advanced need, the only difference is an intermediate's going to be a lot less specialized. In general, intermediates will have like one, maybe two body parts that are like outstandingly weak. But overall, it's just a need for general development. And then advanced, it's like general development's there. It's just like we really need to address this weak body part in order to kind of bring a complete physique. And so when you start to map that out on paper, what does that look like? It's going to be, for the intermediate at least, a more balanced program. So like what you would typically consider some variation of PPL, more than likely, just with slight priority to the body part that you need. So let's say back is a priority for the individual. I'm probably prioritizing back sessions after rest days within the split structure. I'm probably also making sure that a leg day doesn't fully proceed or come in close proximity to any of the pull days. If so, I'm like adding an extra rest day. And then on top of that, using frequency as a tool to get volume up. So two times per rotation is the common. Typically you can fit in a third frequency as far as like fairly easy into a program without reducing recovery capacity. And then I'm just finding where I'm able to plug that third frequency portion in as we get deeper into the program. Rarely do I ever, on the intermediate side, start people at three times per week. On the advanced side, I will, but just kind of depends on where you lay on that spectrum.
Mm-hmm. All right. So if you said an intermediate just got more more work to do in the side of getting weak points, more balanced. So you would say, would you say that the weakest stuff you have to put much more time in to start with the most weakest stuff and prioritize it with the work you can do with the capacities, and bring the second part in, also bring it on the way, but not on the first spot, because if you say someone got like 2 week parts or probably 3 week parts, it's always hard to say okay which we pick now. Which we bring up, keep that and bring the next one going, or bring two on the way and keep one on hold, or keep everything on hold. It's good. So that's stuff that athletes always ask me about. Shouldn't we start with all three stuff, with all the three things that you mentioned? Because I wanted to be next level athlete next season and stuff. And when it comes to the natural side of bodybuilding, we are talking a lot more time that we have to put in. Like probably 2 to 3 year time spans, even probably more. So the time factor when it comes to bodybuilding is also something that most people underestimate, I would think. What would you say?
Yeah, 100%. I think when we look at like significant change, that's kind of where people underestimate it. Like, there's no doubt you can improve year to year slightly, like if you're just disciplined and execute and that kind of stuff. But I think when we look at like the physiques that actually change largely year to year, they're not competing every year, right? Like they're taking the time blocks to vastly improve their physique and be able to set themselves up for a very productive prep. And I think when we look at it in like time perspective for athletes, especially on the natural side, like natural athletes, my guys will, like if I'm coaching natural athletes, it's most of the time 3 years between shows. Like the timetable to recover from prep. Once we recover from prep, then be productive. And then once we're productive, then set ourselves up for a prep. Like I don't see how someone can be make significant physique change unless they're just a genetic anomaly with competing year to year. I especially on the natural side, like I think on a year to year basis within like enhanced bodybuilding, which is where the majority of my coaching is at. I would say like a large percentage of my athletes are enhanced. There is possibility to improve within that year to year times frame. Where I think most people probably would fall the best is the year and a half mark, the year and a half to 2 year. And that's kind of where like enough time to improve, but still kind of get on stage semi-frequently is kind of where the balance is.
So time is something like when we talk about like, I don't know the English word, is it the right word, pitfalls when it comes to the process of becoming an advanced athlete or the next level athlete on stage, it's time. And yeah. Sometimes what would I call it? When you are in an off season for like 3 years, 4 years, to keep the intensity of your progress at a rate, which is good because the adaptations you are getting out after months and years being in the off season, getting shorter and shorter, and you have to work harder and harder. But you're in the off season. You're thinking, I'm more flexible with my food choices. I'm more flexible with my training. I will the last set of abs. I will don't do that, and that accumulates and stuff. And that's what I always think about. Even on the natural side, stuff like 5 years. Can you be productive after your third year being in the off season without getting the spark or the passion of a set of a season, of a competitive season where we get all the mental energy and the motivation and stuff. We see other guys, and then that's also something that I think about. Which is the better way? Yeah, which athlete do you got in front of you? Can he work 6 years straight and keep everything pretty to the no switch fitness standard? Yeah, or is it somewhat after 3 years he have to do a season just to be in the process of competing and then back to the season? That's thing not that easy, I think.
I think there's a lot of value in that too, like keeping someone in that prep mindset, like periodically revisiting it. I would say that there's a couple people I coach that are kind of like just like you described, where we may be pulling the trigger on a prep a little bit early, but it may be more for like what the long-term vision for the physique may be, like keeping them involved and keeping them very passionate about the process. I think where you can typically find the people that are okay with the longer off season, and just to be real, are the people that are, the people that are prep coaches themselves. Mm-hmm. I think they can gather a lot out of their own clientele. Like I can tell you right now, like I'm not competing in 22. Me and my wife are going to try to get pregnant the early part of this year. And then I'm going to spend the back end of it being progressive, but I have a lot of people competing this year and I'm going to be traveling a lot. Like I'm coming to the UK, as you know, for 3 weeks for some seminars. And then right off of the back of that, I've got a pro show that I'm going to be at, and then just a couple national shows back to back. And it's the ball is going to be rolling. I'm going to have a lot of people competing. And I can tell you my favorite time of year is peak season, because I'm working the most and I'm getting to put athletes on stage and seeing them win trophies and win overalls. And it's definitely something that for someone who does lean towards longer off seasons and myself, it never feels like I'm out of prep, because like I'm constantly prepping other people as far as like my own personal process. So it's interesting. It's definitely something to take on a client by client basis. And I think that's where you kind of mentioned this before, like everything we do as coaches needs to be done on an individual basis. Like whether it's training, nutrition, PEDs, whether it's mapping out when they're going to compete, like it's so dependent upon so many inter-individual characteristics that it's so hard to give like generalities, but when you look at like long-term progress over time for natural athletes, like at least 2 years, like at least take 2 years to improve before you get back on, simply from like the recovery process itself, just being able to recover post prep and be able to move on to better progress.
So when it comes to bodybuilding itself, so a guy that always comes to my mind is like AJ. He's someone I would say, if he says he's every day 100% into bodybuilding, I would absolutely say that's completely him. That's completely his personality, his character, and he can always work on that basis from a day to day basis because he is bodybuilding in itself. Yeah? But a lot of athletes haven't grown up that way, socialized in the sport that way, in the form of building a family like you wanted to do now, and like myself, my daughter's now over 1 year old. My life completely changed last year with being a father and stuff. And that's where the part where you see, okay, I would like to be that guy in the old animal pack ad that sits in his kitchen and said, yeah, just eating my egg whites and stuff. And everybody that don't understand me have to go away and stuff. And I absolutely had that time. I loved that time. It was a great time. But things change. Yeah, the factors, external factors change. And that's the stuff where it's get really interesting. To keep athletes at a high baseline of productivity when it comes to muscle building. That's really interesting stuff to adapt to some stuff like that, because as I mentioned earlier, we couldn't be on one side of the spectrum our whole lives. We could be possibly making that possible for the most time if we are working on that, but not all the time. So that's something like I would say it. Obsession like versus flexibility. If we all everybody that hears us would like to be obsessed with bodybuilding, but we have to be flexible to be in a good state, to be productive.
I think there's something that I'll say to clients. It's like urgency with the day-to-day, patience with the process, and that's just like more of a way of me saying like control what you can control. And if you can't control it, then be patient with it, and if it's something you can't control, be urgent with it, right? And I think that there's so much value in that, and like preparing your meals ahead of time and being prepared from that front and doing that kind of thing. But if you get in a car wreck and you don't have your sixth meal with you, like, it's gonna be okay. You can eat when you get home, like take care of your car wreck and do that kind of stuff. Like, life happens, and it happens to everyone, and that's kind of where when we look at like no ulcers in pursuit of results, it can kind of lead people to that obsessive side, which I understand. And it's meant to develop character habits that allow you to understand where you're able to control those things and take no off switch and being able to do what you need to do when it comes to you being able to control it. Something I'll do with my clients though is a tally mark system. So like they have to carry around a sheet of paper and mark down a tally mark for every time they negatively react to something that they couldn't control. And essentially what it's doing is it's teaching them that what you're doing when you react negatively to that is just driving anger up, you're driving cortisol up, you're creating a fight or flight response. And it's like, this is overall a net negative on the day if you're just going to keep doing this to things that you can't control. And I think when we look at creating awareness for an athlete, something that's just tangible of like a tally mark, it's so simple for them to see that they're doing everything that they can to be the best version of themselves that they can, and that to not let things that they can't control get in the way of that.
That's a great method to keep that in perspective and then think about it and see that on paper. And goddamn, today was not a good day because I overreacted all the time. That's a good thing to do in prep. Then you know where your prep status is. If you're freaking out because someone or my daughter is picking my oats when we are eating breakfast, you know, goddamn it. It's my daughter. Keep a fear, huh? No, this is my macros, man. No. that's a good thing to see where the prep status is and where how deep you are in it. So when it comes to coaching, it's also interesting because when it comes to coaching athletes, you also got the personality types that you're working with. Most of the time, you are attracting people that could work with you better, like the more intensity crowd. And then you got the perfectionist detail guy. But I guess every bodybuilder got a part of both in him at points. So how do you work with athletes that fall too much in one direction? How can you keep them rolling with the process? How do you deal with that?
Yeah, so I think it comes down to grounding yourself in the process that the coach lays out. So for me, I have a pretty simple check-in system. Well, I say simple. It's spreadsheets that are like data collectors, right? My goal is to get the person to a place where the data sheet reflects what they're capable of doing, and they can consistently do that on a week-to-week basis. And what I find is, like, no matter where they fall on the spectrum, as long as I can get them plugged in to consistently able to fill out the check-in tracker, execute on taking their photos correctly and uploading them into the right spot, executing on the nutrition from a day-to-day, and reporting when they mess up. I think another one too is, like, we don't prioritize communication, and it's like clients will sometimes expect, like, the bad switch type thing when they go off plan or whatever. And I think that it's more important to actually be honest about what's going on, because that's where my role steps in as a coach to build strategies in order to fix whatever's going on. Right. I think no matter where they fall on the spectrum, like super hyper perfectionist type A, or maybe even more free spirited. I think it's always about bringing them down, because, like, the perfectionist type A is going to drive themselves nuts with driving every data across the sun, under the sun. They're going to drive themselves nuts with 60.5 grams of oats instead of 60. And so it's like bringing them back to be like, hey, this is what's important. Look at the check-in sheet. Like, this is what I need you to track. And this is what matters to actually affecting your process. And if you can do this, I guarantee you, I will get you from where you are to where you want to be. And then same on this side, right? Like, the people who are just free spirited and lackadaisical and see an ice cream cone and just want to go eat it. It's like, if we can again bring them up to, like, hey, like, this is the standard that we need to hold ourselves to. Like, this is what I need you to consistently execute on from a week to week basis. Then we're bringing these people to what I would call, like, the productive happy medium. So have you ever seen, like, a U-curve, like just a general standard U-curve? Mm-hmm. It's basically a U-curve of a response. They'll use it for a representation of the population for responses on basic things. I think there's a lot of value in that, because the peak's always in the middle, right? It's somewhere close to the middle, right? And I think if we look at bodybuilders that from a personality spectrum, from your type A perfectionist to your free-spirited individual, obviously bodybuilding lies more on the type A side of a sport. But I think there's that middle ground of bringing those two together that makes someone the most productive that they can be. And there's a lot of value in that, because I think when you're too far in the perfectionist side, there's a lot of psychological disruption that can happen that can actually lead to worse preps, because we're not able to, in the off season, enjoy the time with family, enjoy the time with friends, and give back to them, so that when it's your time to prep and you need it from them, they can give it back to you, and those kinds of things. And then, like, on the same side, keeping the free spirited person, like, structured enough to be able to make progress, you need to bring them into this realm, right? So, and I'll be real, like, just from who I am as a person and the kind of content I put out, no off switch in the pursuit of results, like, 9 times out of 10, the person that's on my clientele roster is the type A perfectionist, right? Like, it's just what I deal with the most. But it doesn't mean that we can't have strategies in order to bring people into that productive place. And I think that that's where, no matter what you're presented with, if you can get people to buy into, like, hey, like, this is the system, let's follow this system and let's move forward, then we'll really be able to move someone forward, because the whole point in the system is that it's flexible to the individual. It's a check-in tracker that's an Excel spreadsheet that can be determined what we're tracking and what we're not tracking according to what that individual needs. It can be set up according to the person's structure of the day and all these other things. And so it's still a system, though, and it still allows them to be centered and grounded in something that's productive.
Mm, great. That's the word that you mentioned, like the buy-in part. I guess that's
so big.
So big. The communication part, building buy-in when it comes to someone who have to change a little bit that direction of his personality or the priorities. If you buy into the stuff that you have to do for that, it goes faster in the right direction. That's because we bring the whole context and the communication why we do stuff. And I guess that's probably one of the key factors when it comes to bringing athletes from point A to B. And once again, from A to B. And 100%. It's as you mentioned, if you got athletes that just apply themselves and just do stuff and don't ask too much about it, it's great. But I think sometimes these athletes could also be better if they have more context behind what they do. They bring the intensity, and that the context behind it would bring up the quality of and intensity up.
And I think maybe just as a clarification, like, the workhorse athlete should ask questions. I just think that the workhorse athlete asks better questions, right? And I think it's not because of who they are. It's because of them being so involved in the process. They're asking tangible questions that are productive to the process. And I think that that's where, like, asking questions is such a good aspect of coaching. It's how I talked about earlier, like, a lot of times bringing an athlete up a level requires education in order to bring that athlete up to another level. And like, even my check-in sheet has a questions for coach portion built out on it, right? In order for the people to ask those questions, I think communicating with your coach is partly about asking the right questions and asking questions that allow you to be more productive. Because like you said, once you get the context, the buy-in is there and the quality is even higher. Yeah. And it's just really important.
So great that the mention of athletes asking better questions. If they're asking better questions, they're growing, once again, mentally and then physically too. That's great. That's great. So we talked a lot about coaching and bringing athletes from A to B. I got one last topic, which is more like in the trenches stuff. The importance of fatigue management, which get a lot more attention nowadays, I would say a good amount of attention than like 5 years ago or 10 years ago, where I never thought about fatigue. I think if I'm fatigued from training, that's okay. I'm growing. That's part of the game, but I never had the equation of, stimulate the muscle, recover, and then adapt. I never get that sequence in place. And when I get that, it completely changed my own training, my programming and stuff. So when it comes to fatigue management, what are the main things you do when it comes to deload, active rest periods? Where your stance on that? What do you like the most of the time with even once again the intermediate to advanced athletes?
Moin moin, Arne hier. Ganz kurze Unterbrechung, um dich auf die Nettohypertrophie hinzuweisen. Du strebst nach maximaler Hypertrophie, du fragst dich, ob das Steigern des Gewichts auf der Hantel oder doch eher die Mind-Muscle-Connection Priorität hat, ob die Intensität, also die Nähe zum Muskelversagen, ausschlaggebend sind oder doch eher ein dynamisches Trainingsvolumen. Kurz gesagt, alle diese Faktoren sind relevant, wenn es um Hypertrophie geht. Die Nettohypertrophie bietet eine Trainingsplanung, die all diesen Faktoren gerecht wird und einen Zeitraum von 4 Monaten über 3 Phasen, also 3 Mesozyklen, jedem der genannten Faktoren zur passenden Zeit seine stärkste Rolle spielen lässt. Die einzelnen Phasen sind so gestaltet, dass die Ergebnisse in Form von Anpassungen die nächste Phase befeuern. Diese Phasenpotenzierung ermöglicht es auch, Adaptionswiderstände, also Prozesse, die positive Anpassungen mit der Zeit kleiner ausfallen lassen, zu kontern und über alle 3 Phasen möglichst viel Nettohypertrophie zu produzieren. Wenn du also ein Trainingssystem suchst zu einem fairen Preis, dann schau jetzt in die Beschreibung und ich freue mich, dich bei der Nettohypertrophie begrüßen zu dürfen.
Yeah, so I think I think it's all in where are you catching the athlete? I know there's a lot of people who are kind of in the camp of pushing athletes to a point where volume levels are accumulating to such a high point that we're seeing maybe not large performance detriments, but we're seeing performance decrements. And then there's kind of like the people who lean more towards pre-planned, more frequent deloads, where it's maybe deloading the athlete a little before, in my argument's case, the necessity of one. And I think that there's a reason that we coach and on an inter-individual spectrum is because we should be looking for trends. We shouldn't be looking for a certain week or a certain volume level or anything along those lines. I think where I go with deloads is tracking subjective metrics. So how's your sleep quality? How's your brain fog throughout the day? How is your irritability? How is your desire to go train? How's your hunger signaling? These kinds of things, I think we'll see the need for a deload in those before we'll see the performance actually be detrimental in the gym, especially with the population that I serve, just very gung-ho about training, very type A, very I'm going to progress today no matter what it takes. A lot of times what I'll see is, and the way my check-in tracker works is those subjective metrics are color-coded. So as they're filling their check-in tracker out, you can see the trend of like green, we're good. It was a five, and then it went to a four, green, and then it went to a three, which is yellow, and then went to a two, which is, and so you can kind of see the trend over time. And then just in the open-ended section, you'll see the dialogue start to change about like how they're feeling on a day-to-day basis, how they're feeling going into training. And I think when we can catch those subjective metrics going down, that's when we need to pull the deload rather than seeing the performance detriments going down. Because in my opinion, for most people, performance decrements are the last thing to kind of fall off the edge of the table. And I think that when we look at area of peak response, so like someone optimally adapting to a program setup, which would be at the peak of the U curve, we want to catch people before they kind of start falling off that peak too far. And I think if we push to the points that we're seeing performance decrements in the gym, we're probably past that point of peak response. We're possibly extending the length and need of the deload. And so when I'm catching people on this subjective metric decline, a lot of times, like my deloads are 4 or 5 days, and then they're good to go again and still into a very progressive long string block. So when it's time to transition into deloads, how I do that is a little context dependent upon the athlete. General trends though, frequency pulled out. So frequency is a volume metric. So if we can add in rest days, pull out the frequency, we're going to be doing a volume drop within that. And then the session volume will drop 35 to 50% depending on the athlete. And then the first few sessions will be reintroduction of RIR. So for me, in the way that a large portion of my people like to train, I have a couple people who will kind of keep the RIRs in and we'll kind of do that setup. But the majority of them, the progressions come from like a start of a block is week one, set the logbook, reps and reserve is in play. Week two, week three is about the removal of reps and reserve. And then we're going into the block, being progressive, where now the progressions are just set progressions. So we're adding a set here, we're adding a set there. And most of my guys will be productive across a block for 12 to 16 weeks and before we're needing to do anything. And then we get to that deload, we pull out the frequency, we pull the volume per session down, introduce RIR. And then typically the last session of the deload is no reps in reserve, still at the reduced volume level, more so testing if we've reinstated performance capacity. And if we have, we're going back into the training block. And so that's kind of how I structure it. It's a little bit different than the way a lot of people do deloads. I'm not constrained by a week. I'm constrained by the need of the athlete. And so, like, some athletes need 4 days, some athletes need 8. And then I just, that's kind of where I'm going with it.
That's a pretty interesting approach with the last days or the last day of the deload to test where the athletes stand, what his performance look like, and what the mesos should start with. Because I think a lot of athletes, overdo it in the first week or underdo it in the first week, and the baseline is not where it could be, and you're not buying or losing like 1 to 2 weeks upfront or in the end what you could handle. And as you mentioned, I think in the natural realms, I think that the trend goes a lot more with more frequent deloads and more proactive deloads. I think the trend is more there, just to keep the athlete productive in the baseline. But like it's not like this, as you mentioned, it's not like 5 weeks, it's not like 8 weeks. There are individuals that could do 12, probably 16, if everything's worked fine and they progress in their recovery capacities in that time. It could be a progression on that scheme. They are on holidays, they don't have to work for 3 weeks and stuff, capacities going up. So I think deloads should be all time pretty individual when it comes to using them, because get the fatigue out of the system and get like in the pole position for the next push of growth.
100%.
That's that changed for me. That changed a lot, as I mentioned before, because back in the days, the animal pack days, there was no days off, there was no deloads. There was the deloads that your body was giving you because you was injured, you was sick, and that was a crazy time, a good time, but now deloads are a good approach. So Luke, one last question, a question that I'm ask any guest on the podcast. What was the last thing you have switched your stance on when it comes to bodybuilding stuff? Bodybuilding.
Ooh, that's good. Last thing I switched my stance on. That's hard. I feel like I'm ever evolving. Like, as a coach, in that there's things that you learn that improve your capacity as a coach. I would probably say it's a little bit more on the PED side, like the health management side of things, is probably where a lot of my opinions have switched, in that I think you can compete at a very high level with still being very detailed and in your deployment of compounds and understanding the outcomes from each compound deployment at a very specific level can lead to overall better outcomes as an athlete, but also as like a long-term health perspective as well. And I think that a lot of my opinions within the PED realm in the female side is kind of where most of my opinions have changed a lot over the last, I'd say, 9 months. And that's probably the most recent thing that has been developed in my coaching practice, is finding hormonal homeostasis for athletes for being the baseline of PED introduction rather than going super physiological. Because within like the female population, like hormonal homeostasis is not overly common. And you need to find hormonal homeostasis for that person, right? Like asking the right questions. Are they ovulating? Are they like, what does their menstrual cycle look like? Those kinds of things. And finding what should be a productive hormonal homeostasis for them, rather than the conversation that had kind of been of past, is like, what compounds are safe for women to use? And it's like, yeah, we can have that conversation, but is the athlete even in a spot to include PEDs? And that's probably where most of my thoughts have shifted, is like, where do I start an athlete? And that's kind of probably where a lot of my thought is. So training to me, like, man, like the general principles are going to apply, like execute well, train hard, manage your recovery. Like pretty much most setups will work. It's just when we look at like optimizing response, it's just optimizing those variables according to the person. And then I think that when it comes to nutrition, like it's the same thing. Like you're going to have general tenets that work, and we have specific cases like GI disruption, SIBO, things like that are going to make the nutrition side a lot harder. But I think a lot of my opinion shifting rather than maybe just like understanding that the variables are so changeable across people is probably within managing female athletes for sure.
Okay, great. So it's a lot more shifting than switching when it comes to when it comes to bodybuilding training.
Yeah, like I'm always open to a better idea.
Yeah.
I need you to convince me that's a better idea. Like you need to have your ducks in a row and you need to be able to explain it to me. And if I can refute it with a logic that's better, then like it's going to be harder for me to buy into that. Right. And so that's where I guess it's more shifting rather than like completely change. And it's just being able to, the more you coach and the more clients that you coach, the more you have to shift because there's no one system that works for everyone.
Yeah, that's what we have to learn. And that's a good ending because we come back to the start of the podcast where you mentioned that that the most important part of being a better bodybuilder, being the next level bodybuilder, is be open to learn and to not switch, but to shift when it comes to stuff that's important in your process. I guess that's a good ending point for all the stuff we are talked about. So Luke, absolute pleasure. I guess the audience will love the episode. Where can they find you? Where can they reach out to you? What's our stuff that you would like to plug in the near future?
Yeah, for sure. So No Switch Fitness on Instagram, No Switch Fitness on YouTube. Pretty easy to find. As far as coaching inquiries go, I have an inquiry form on my bio and my link in my Instagram, so just go find it. As far as events go, this is pretty big. We've got one event in the UK that's going to be at Ultraflex Rotherham. So that'll be March 26th and 27th. And we actually have a second event in the UK that's going to be happening in March as well. Can't announce it yet because we haven't announced it yet, but just pay attention to my page and you'll see when that's coming. It'll be the week before. So it'll actually be March 20th. So we'll be in the UK for 3 weeks. So if you're in the UK listening or you want to come over for the seminar, please do. We'd love to meet you. And that's kind of like what I got going on right now.
Great. Great. So if you are in Europe, I guess a lot of people, it would be pretty easy to fly into the UK. A lot of the German speaking audience. There were a lot of seminars before Rona hit the world. UK was always a great place to learn and to meet like-minded individuals. So Luke, absolute pleasure. If the listeners get any questions, post them on the YouTube video, DM us or something. We will get back to you for sure. Yeah. We'll probably bring you on in a few months if I got so much I want to talk to you about.
Yeah, so, for sure. 100% happy to come back on anytime.
Great. Luke, have a great day. And the audience, thank you for hearing us. And see you next time. Bye-bye.